This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. America may be the only military superpower, but we face stiff economic competition from Europe and Japan. My guest, Lester Thoreau, says in the post-Cold War era, the main contest has shifted from a military to an economic contest. Unfortunately, he says Europe and Japan are playing by new business rules, while we're playing by old, outdated ones. Thoreau was once described as the most famous economist in America who has not been the host of a PBS TV series. He's the dean of the MIT Sloan School of Management. Thoreau is probably best known as the author of the bestseller, The Zero-Sum Society. His new book is Head to Head, The Coming Economic Battle Among Japan, Europe, and America. So what's at stake in this confrontation?
Well, what's basically at stake is the high-wage jobs, because everybody in the world wants the high-wage jobs. But the important thing to understand is that this is what I call a competitive, cooperative ball game. It's not just competition, and the other side is not our enemy. They're our rivals, but not our enemies. And I think it's going to be a much, and there are a whole set of things we have to do cooperatively. And so I think it's going to be a much more subtle ball game. There are no evil empires. Nobody gets shot, nobody gets hung, nobody gets taken prisoner. But the fact of the matter is there are people out there in the world who are working very hard to make sure that the industries which are going to generate the high-wage jobs in the 21st century are in their country and not in the United States.
And what industries are those?
Well, the seven key industries that everybody thinks are going to be very important in the 21st century are microelectronics, biotechnology, the new material science industries, telecommunication, civilian aircraft manufacturing, robots plus machine tools, computers plus software, and those would be very high on anybody's set of lists.
Well, you think that Americans really aren't keeping up with the changing rules of the game. For instance, Americans are very self-conscious about how the Japanese have basically cornered the market on video technology. You say that right now those who can make a product cheaper can take it away from the country that actually invented the product. So what does that mean? What implications are in that for where we put our emphasis in industry?
Well, I think they make a tremendous difference, because if the name of the game is invent the new product, for example, if you're looking at education and skills, the education and skills that count are basically the top 20% of the population, because somebody in that group will invent the new product. If the name of the game is being the world's cheapest producer of that product, then in some sense the education and skills that are count that are the bottom 50%, because people in that group are going to staff the processes, and if they can't do just-in-time inventories, if they can't do statistical quality control, you can't build that product. Inside our corporations, it means instead of allocating your talent to new product development, you have to allocate your talent to your factories. And the route to the top has to change. And so these things have some very profound changes on how we run our corporations and how we run our society.
Well, following this line of thought that the Japanese are making a fortune marketing and producing the products that have been invented in America, what are the research and development implications for that? Are we putting our money in the right place?
Well, I think the answer is no. At the moment, we're putting about two-thirds of our money into new product development and about one-third into process. The Japanese do exactly the opposite. Two-thirds into process and one-third into a new product. And we need to look a lot more like the Japanese in terms of spending patterns. But we've also got another big R&D problem, and that is that you and I in America have basically run a military R&D system for the last 50 years. About half of all R&D is done by the military. We're going to have to build a civilian R&D system, and we don't know exactly how to do that. And see, that's where benchmarking becomes important. If you're America or an American, you now have to look at the rest of the world and say, what is the best performance standard in the world? Now, you don't have to do it the way they do it, but you have to match that performance standard. And see, there again, Americans for 50 years have basically gotten out of the habit of looking at the rest of the world, because we say, well, who's the best in the world? Well, obviously, Americans. Now, in many industries, and certainly in consumer electronics is one, Americans are not the best. And therefore, if we want to play in that ballgame, we've got to benchmark vis-a-vis those that are the best and learn how to do it in the United States.
My guest is economist Lester Thoreau, author of the new book, Head to Head, The Coming Economic Battle Among Japan, Europe, and America. You probably also know Lester Thoreau as the author of The Zero-Sum Society. Well, the playing field economically is going to change on January 1st, 1993, when the European Community is officially formed. What are some of the advantages they're going to have?
Well, they will become the largest economy in the world. And see, America has been the largest economy in the world for about 120 years. And so if you want to play major league economics, you'll go to Europe. And if you want to play AAA ball, you'll be in the United States. Now, the important thing for Americans, however, is that it's always been one of the rights and privileges of the world's largest economy to write the rules for world trade. In the 19th century, the British wrote the rules for world trade. In the 20th century, we Americans wrote the rules for world trade, called the Gatt-Bretton Woods system. In the 21st century, the Europeans will write the rules for world trade, and so we Americans are going to have to learn to play by European rules. Now, if you say, what rules are the Europeans going to write? What I argue is they're going to write the rules for a system which I would call quasi-trading blocks with managed trade. That'll put a tremendous premium on the ability of countries to have governments and corporations work closely together. And the best illustration of the way the Europeans do it, of course, is Airbus Industries, a private company but owned by the British, French, German, and Spanish governments, designed to crack the American monopoly in aircraft manufacturing, and it's been very successful at doing it. Now, our current response to Airbus Industries is to have a tenter tantrum and yell they're cheating, but the fact of the matter is they're going to write the rules, and Airbus Industries doesn't violate any treaty we, they, or anybody else has ever signed or is going to sign.
Americans have run on the principle that government doesn't participate with private industry in projects, whereas the Europeans and the Japanese believe government should play a role in the economic growth of private industry. So are they officially violating our rules? I mean, could we in America do an Airbus kind of arrangement where the government was playing a part in the creation of this new technology?
Well, they're not violating any rules, but they're not playing the game the way we played it, as you pointed out. They're playing it very differently. Now, if you think about Airbus Industries, it's not to say that we in America should do exactly what the Europeans have done in Airbus Industries, but we have to match them in some dimension. And I think there's no question about it that we're going to have to overcome our history, and governments and industry are going to have to learn to work together in what could be called a growth strategy or a growth policy or something. Because if we don't do that, we will find that we're increasingly squeezed out of high-wage industries.
Okay, when you talk about trading blocks, there's on some level that could be like antitrust in our country. And when you talk about government support of industry, well, that could be some kind of socialism in our country,
see,
the way it would be interpreted. Yeah.
You're now using a set of words the rest of the world doesn't worry about.
Uh-huh.
The rest of the world isn't worried about antitrust. They don't think that's a very important thing, and we're going to have to change our antitrust laws to play the game the rest of the world plays. The rest of the world, you know, isn't worried about the word socialism one way or another. If you look at the German government, it owns more shares and more companies than probably any non-communist government on the face of the earth. They own Lufthansa, shares in steel companies, shares in Volkswagen. But if you talk to the German who heads Lufthansa, he would tell you he ran a private corporation. And the fact that government owns some of the shares, to him, is an irrelevant fact. And so they really look at the world quite differently than we do.
The antitrust laws are supposed to be protecting consumers and businesses. How would you like to see them changed?
Well, the simple fact of the matter is most of them are now technologically obsolete. Let me just give you a brief example. Under our antitrust laws, it would be illegal for Ford and General Motors to put up a joint production facility to basically run Toyota out of business. But under our antitrust laws, it's perfectly legal for General Motors and Toyota to have a joint production facility in California, as they do, to run Ford out of business. Now, that's called shooting yourself in the foot. Because our antitrust laws pay no attention to what's going on in the rest of the world. And the fact of the matter is that we can't enforce our antitrust laws in the rest of the world. We're going to have to play a game defined by them, not a game defined by what would Americans like to do.
What kind of government involvement in industry would you like to see? I mean, traditionally in America, the government has given research and development money to industries involved with the military. And that's helped some civilian industries, like the aeronautics industry. But what expanded role would you like to see the government play?
Well, one of the places government's going to have to play a role is building this new civilian R&D system, because you're quite right to point out that we've had a military system in the past, and it has had some spinoffs into private industry. But the great thing about a military system is the military knew what it wanted. An airplane that flew at 5,000 miles an hour, a missile that landed within 20 feet, and a submarine that stayed underwater forever. If you're talking about civilian R&D, you have to know what you want. All technologies are not created equal. Some lead to big, important industries with lots of high-wage jobs, and others lead to economic dead ends. And so you have to have a bit of an industrial vision out there. Now, that doesn't mean that the government has to pick winners and losers. The way they do it in Europe, in Brussels, is they have a whole set of products, projects called things like Eureka, Esprit, Jesse, Vision 2500, and these projects all run in a very similar way. The government says, we think this is an important area. We have some money. If you, the private business firms, will get together three firms from at least two different countries and come through the door with 50% of the money, we'll match it if we think it's a good project. And so what it means is that private industry is picking the winners, but the government is then lengthening the time horizon, cutting the costs in half because they match it with half the money. And it allows the corporations to do very different things. But this idea of having a vision as to where you want to go is something that we Americans are going to have to learn how to formulate. Now, that doesn't mean we have to formulate it in a European way or a Japanese way, but it does mean we do have to formulate it in some way that we find consistent with American history, tradition, culture, whatever.
If you're just joining us, my guest is economist Lester Thoreau. You say that the Japanese economic goal is market share maximization. What is that? What do you mean?
Well, I use the phrase producer economics, and I think the easiest way to think about it is think about two farmers. One is running his farm in kind of an Anglo-Saxon American way, and that is he's a cost minimizer, a profit maximizer. He buys a used tractor if that's the most efficient thing to do. He's very careful, but then he earns some money at the end of the day. And at the end of the day, he splurges it on anything he likes. He buys a Mercedes. He takes a Caribbean vacation. He has a big house. We say, spend it any way you like. The other farmer says, I'm not interested in the big Mercedes. I'm not interested in the house. I'm not interested in the Caribbean vacation. What I want is the world's finest tractor, the biggest barn, the grand champion cow. I'm interested in producer goods and services. And I'm going to get to ride that tractor a lot longer than I get to ride my Mercedes. Now, the problem is, suppose those two farmers are competing with each other. Which one wins? Well, it's clear which one wins. The guy who's putting his money into the barn, the tractor, the cow. And see, the Japanese have been organized a society that puts a lot more emphasis on producer goods, somewhat less emphasis on consumer goods, and they're going to force us to change. Last year, they invested twice as much as we did in plant and equipment. Doesn't take a genius to know that we can't continue to invest half as much and still have the high-wage jobs of the world. And so this is a perfect example of where some other society in the world, in this case the Japanese, are going to force very profound changes in the American system, or the American system is not going to generate a world-class standard of living. And, you know, you can say, well, that's a hard-nosed choice, but the fact of the matter is it's the real choice.
Japanese companies have been taking over some American companies, Sony, a good example of that. Columbia is the example. Sony took over Columbia.
Columbia Pictures, yeah.
Yeah. What's the significance to America's economic future? With Japan taking over American companies?
Well, it's important to focus on the right things.
Yeah.
The right things is not worrying about Japanese companies buying companies in the United States, because when they do that, they will bring some technology, some management, some investment, and that's a good thing. The thing to worry about is the thing I document in the book is that the Japanese run a system where basically nobody's been able to run successful companies in Japan. And if you look for companies that are at least 51% owned by foreigners, there, in order to find 132 of them, you have to go all the way down to annual sales of $5 million a year. And some very famous American names in Japan don't have 51% American ownership. Disney Tokyo is not owned by American Disney. McDonald's is not owned by American McDonald's. And the real problem is the rest of the world, not just America, has found it impossible to buy companies in Japan, and that asymmetry is the problem. Nothing to worry about them buying things here, a lot to worry about us being unable to buy things there.
So if they're playing unfair with us by not allowing us to really buy companies there while they buy companies here, what can we do to change that?
Well, the answer is we have to get our house in order. But see, I don't like using the word unfair, because unfair implies that you're violating some set of rules that everybody's agreed on. The Japanese are not violating any set of rules that anybody has ever agreed on. They're not playing the game the American way, but that doesn't mean that they're unfair. And see, I think that's the distinction that has to be made. And so what we, you know, I think there is a real issue on opening up the Japanese economy. It's not an issue between America and Japan. It's an issue between Japan and the rest of the world, because nobody has been successful at cracking into the Japanese economy. The Germans can't do it. The Koreans can't do it. The Italians can't do it. The Americans can't do it. And one of the problems, and it's a Japanese problem that'll have to be solved, is if we want a functioning world economy, Japan has got to be willing to both import more from the rest of the world and allow the rest of the world to acquire assets in Japan.
If you're just joining us, my guest is economist Lester Thoreau. He's the dean of MIT's Sloan School of Management, author of the bestseller Zero Sum Society, and author of the new book, Head to Head. We're going to take a short break, then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Economist Lester Thoreau is my guest. You've come up with a phrase, the American disease, to describe the American obsession with relocating to a, a pla- place where you could pay really low wages, whether that means locating to a region of America or relocating your plant to a third world country. You think it's a big mistake?
Yeah, it's a big mistake because, see, people talk about the British disease, and by that they mean kind of adversarial labor management relations, lots of work rules, those things. The American disease is this belief that low wages solve all the problems. If you're in trouble as a corporation, just go to someplace where wages are lower. The fact of the matter is the only way you can be successful is to go upscale on skills and productivity. Because if the name of the game is low wages, there's always somebody in the world who's paying lower wages. Low wages are easy to copy. High productivity, high skills are hard to copy, and American firms are too prone to bail out as opposed to do the tough job of going upscale in terms of skills, technology, product problems.
Use the textile industry as an example. Well, when a textile company moves to a third world country and they're paying seamstresses very little money to sew things onto dresses or whatever, what's high tech in that? I mean,
well, for example, let's look at the textile industry. The world's largest exporter of textiles is mainland China. No great mystery there. Low wages. But who are the second and third largest exporter of textiles? Well, the answer is Italy and Germany. Mm-hmm. Italy has wages in the textile industry which are as high as American wages, and German wages are way above American wages. The question is, why are they a success and we're a failure? Well, they don't compete with China making men's underwear, but what they've done is defined a fashion industry, a special fabric industry, a quick response industry that can, in fact, compete paying high wages and doing a lot of exporting. A couple of Christmases ago, my secretary gave me a scarf. A scarf is just a rectangular piece of cloth. I looked at the label and I was flabbergasted because it said made in Germany. How can the Germans pay higher wages than Americans, make a rectangular piece of cloth, export it to the United States, and do it successfully? Well, the answer is the label said it was a new fabric called cashmink, which was supposed to have the good characteristics of both cashmere and mink. And they were able to sell that product as something unique in the American market as a premium. And the question is, why didn't Americans do that? And the answer is a certain lack of imagination and this belief the only thing you can do is basically go for low wages if you're in the textile business.
So if you're trying to rebuild the industry with the emphasis on more skilled labor and more innovative ideas, then you've really got to improve the education system.
Absolutely. Both improve it in the K-12 system and improve it once people graduate from high school. See, this is the only industrial country in the world where there's no post-secondary education system for the non-college bound. The Germans have their apprenticeship system. The Singaporeans do bonding. The French have a 1% of sales tax where every firm has to put 1% of its sales into a fund, which it can only use for training. And if it doesn't train workers with that fund, the government takes the money away. So you're going to do the training because it becomes a free good. And we could do any one of those three or a unique American system. But the fact of the matter is graduating from high school isn't good enough anymore, even if you happen to graduate from a good high school.
You've been very critical of the American economy and American industry during our discussion. What do you think are some of the strengths that America has now?
Well, see, if you take those seven industries that I mentioned and you go through them, you see a lot of American strengths. If you look at microelectronics, that's basically, I think, an even fight between Japan and the United States. There are some places where the Japanese are ahead, like consumer electronics, but there are some places where we're ahead on things like military electronics. If you look at biotechnology, that's an American lead. We've got more PhDs in biotechnology than the rest of the world have combined. If you look at the new material science industries, that ought to be an American strength because we've used a lot of those materials in the military, and the only question now is how do you make them more cheaply and use them in the civilian economy. If you look at telecommunication, I think that's a rather even battle between Japan, Europe, and the United States. If you look at aircraft, that's a battle between Europe and the United States with Japan out of it. If you look at robotics plus machine tools, that's the one place where we're just simply out of it. It's a battle between the Europeans and the Japanese. And then if you look at computers and software, on computers it's a battle between us and the Japanese, but we probably still have a lead, and on computer software we still have a monopoly. So if you think of those critical industries, we have a very good starting position. The problem is, if you did that evaluation in 1980, it would have looked stronger than 1990. The problem is not where we are at the moment, it's the trends, which look very adverse, and the question is, in the 1990s, can we turn those trends around?
So when you look at the competition between the European community, Japan, and the United States economically, who do you think is going to, quote, win?
Well, I argue at the end of the book it's probably will be the Europeans because the Europeans have strategic position. And I use the analogy with a book on chess endgames where they give you a complicated chessboard. and they say black can win in five moves regardless of what white does. Now figure out the five moves. And Europe has exactly that position. They have the strategic position on the chessboard. They may lose, but if they do it right, they can win, and there's nothing that anybody in the United States or Japan can do about it, because Europe is going to get all the economies of scale. There are 800 or 900 million people in Europe, depending on what you think about the Turks and Turkey and in the southern Soviet Union. They're all well-educated. Think about it. You got Germany, who's a world production export leader, Russia, who's a world science leader, Italy and France, who are world leaders in design, world capital market in London. If you can put the best aspects of all those countries together, you can create a winner that could dominate both Japan and the United States. On the other hand, the Europeans may not be able to bring it off, and they may throw it away.
Lester Thoreau, you were one of Paul Tsongas' economic advisors. How did you feel about his suspension of his campaign?
Well, I think, you know, the basic problem we're talking about here is we're at this transition point when Americans are kind of have a lot of free-floating anxiety, fear, hostility, all those kind of things, and they feel a little bit cheated. And they need somebody who can point out to them what is the direction for solving these problems in the next decade. And to do that, you both have to know where you want to go and have to be one of the world's great salesmen. And I guess the thing you'd have to say about the Tsongas campaign is, in some sense, he proved he was not one of the world's great salesmen since he had to drop out. But the idea that we have to have a growth policy, which is one of the ideas he was selling, I think sooner or later we're going to come to that realization. And if we come to it sooner, we're going to be much better off than if we come to it later.
Lester Thoreau, thank you very much for talking with us.
You're welcome.
And Lester Thoreau is the author of the new book, Head to Head, The Coming Economic Battle Among Japan, Europe, and America. He's also the dean of MIT's Sloan School of Management. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.